ExchangeWire's ATS Singapore conference returns on July the 2nd. Grab your ticket now and secure your place. You'll hear the latest on retail media, curation for marketing, the impact of AI on the industry, and much, much more. ATS Singapore 2025 will feature the latest insights from an exceptional group of speakers, highlighting future challenges and breakthroughs in media, marketing, and e-commerce. Visit exchangewire.com/events for more details.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy, editor at ExchangeWire, and your host for today's episode. We're here for another in-person podcast today, which is always exciting. I'm here with our CEO, Rachel Smith. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Amy. It's lovely to be doing another in-person podcast. It feels very 2019.
Yeah, I love it. And head of content, John Steele. How are you, John?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, very, very warm in London today.
Yeah, very warm. I love it. Yeah.
No complaints from me either.
No,
yeah,
just me.
It was a bit cold earlier with the aircon, but I've sorted that now. So,
aircon versus windows open. It's the bane of every office situation.
The full battle in the ExchangeWire office this morning.
Yeah. Today we'll be discussing a potential takeover for ITV, publishers witnessing a spike in Facebook referral traffic, and TikTok's plans to enter Japan's e-commerce market. So our first story is from the Financial Times. French media giant Banijay Group is working on plans for a takeover offer for ITV or its studio arm, according to two people familiar with the situation. This would bring together two of Europe's largest TV production groups. Early talks between both groups have been held. Currently, ITV is valued at just over $3 billion. John, how could the merging of these two media groups change the current landscape?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Banijay are not scared of spending. They are one of the industry's big acquirers. I know they bought Endemol Shine for $2.2 billion 5 years ago, which was a big outlay and created one of the biggest companies, biggest media companies in Europe. So they are, you know, they're in the market for this kind of thing. And they've obviously seen that this value in ITV and ITV studios. It's like, it's interesting to see that kind of consolidation in the TV market. They're two really, really big players, and them coming together obviously creates a pretty big player in the European scene as well as the world scene. I'm interested to see that TV production. You know, we talk about it being increasingly fragmented and all through the streaming platforms, but it's interesting that behind the scene, the production houses are consolidating. You know, it's heading, we're not heading towards the 5-4-3 record label situation we had with the major labels, but we are certainly, deals like this are creating a more consolidated background to the fragmented streaming landscape. So, big money, ITV worth over $3 billion. They think their studio arm might be worth more than that anyway, more than their market cap. So big deal. Yeah,
very big deal. Rachel, what do you think on that?
So I think that this is, if they were to pull it off, it is, from a strategic point of view, I think it's these companies setting themselves up as a direct competitor with some of the incumbent streaming giants. You know, they are both production companies that make content not just for their own networks, but they also make content that's distributed to global streaming networks like Disney, Netflix, HBO Max. And I guess from a financial point of view, they're probably thinking, well, actually, since we produce content for these other streamers, there has to be a way for us to consolidate and potentially grow revenue and gain scale from joining our combined studios and production companies and networks. And you could imagine a world where if they did pull off a successful merger, then they stop licensing the content that they have been producing to Netflix, Disney Plus, HBO Max, and just make it available via their own platform, whatever that would look like under a consolidated, media proposition. I think that also, this comes at a really interesting time where there's news of some of those streaming giants and other broadcasters and producers not spending the same amount of money on producing content, therefore looking to license content that's produced by other studios. And that feeds into your point, I think, John, that are we seeing a period in history in TV streaming where consolidation is becoming a successful business strategy because actually you just can't keep growing growing these independent content production houses because it's super expensive and scale and reach across audience is so critical. So I think you're right. We're maybe not necessarily just around the corner from four big record companies, as you characterized it, but I do think we're probably heading into a marketplace where you're going to see potential acquisitions like this or mergers like this crop up a little more often. I think it's super interesting that it's these two companies, because it wasn't that long ago that there was conversations of mergers between TF1 and, I want to say, they already do a lot of stuff with Channel 4, but there was someone else, another UK broadcaster.
I think ITV wanted to buy all three media. I think that was mooted a few years ago, and that actually never came to pass.
So it'd be really interesting to understand, wouldn't it, exactly who's driving this. Is it ITV then, maybe, because this is the second time that we're hearing about their ambitions for some kind of merger or acquisition. But either way, it seems like there is some real opportunity here amongst European broadcasters to create a credible alternative in the current marketplace. You know, if this was sort of 3-4 years ago and these people were looking to compete with Netflix and Disney Plus, that might be harder. But now, because those streamers are not investing the same amount in content production as they were, and these broadcasters are licensing content already to those companies, we're now starting to see, you know, you could call them the sort of second wave market entrants. They're traditional broadcasters, but they're learning how to create a streaming platform business over time.
Yeah, and we had on the podcast back end of last year, we had Reese McLaughlin join us from ITV, and he was saying how well ITVX has been performing as a platform, and he was quite bullish on its prospects and, you know, competing in the streaming landscape. So really interesting that this could be part of that deal, whether they do it just for studios or, you know, ITV itself is to be seen.
Yeah.
But ITVX, I assume, would be part of that. And your point regarding the buying in of content needed from the production houses is really interesting, because, you know, Netflix aren't spending what they used to on content. No.
Which is not surprising, right? No. Like, they can't have endless pockets, and content production is super expensive. Sorry, John, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's exactly that point. And they were spending so much money and then being so quick with the trigger. Once it didn't work, they'd bin it, which is no way to make money particularly. So it's interesting. They are doing a lot more outsourcing of production now. I mean, Apple seem to be able to keep spending incredible amounts of monies on series because it is a loss leader for them, Apple Plus. They will keep making high quality series with the biggest names possible for huge budgets, and it doesn't matter to them. It's just there for people who want to watch it. Amazon have scaled back a little bit. I think they were burnt by the Lord of the Rings series, Rings of Power. They haven't fully released what that did commercially, but I don't think it was what they hoped for given what they spent on it. And I think the power of the production house is higher than ever. So this deal in that context certainly makes sense.
Mm. And Rachel, do you think this potential merger would be a good thing?
I mean, you could look at this from several different angles, right? One is that it...
I guess sort of for the smaller players kind of in the landscape.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was just about to say that I think from a sort of overall health of competition in the marketplace, yes, because it means that it gives some kind of vision for other broadcasters and content, whether it's even small standalone content production companies that aren't necessarily directly affiliated with a broadcaster, or whether it is other broadcasters across European countries, because we know that the TV landscape is very fragmented but also can be very region and country specific. But actually now, if you're a broadcaster in other European companies and this merger were to go ahead, do you think to yourself, maybe there's actually an opportunity here? And I think that provides a more even playing field and a more competitive market. So I think that's both an opportunity for content providers and broadcasters, but it's also an opportunity for potential ad-funded models and therefore advertisers, and it's a potential, of course, for consumers. You know, more competition is almost always better for consumers, at least, well, in general. I was going to say at least in the short term, because you start to see price competition, but I think actually even in the longer term, because, you know, we all know what happens once you start to see monopolies being produced. So I think on that in that front on that side, it's good news. The downside, I suppose, is that you, as ever, the devil is in the detail. So as John mentioned earlier on, are we talking about just a merging of studios? Are we talking about more of a complete merging of broadcasters? Could that fragment the TV consumption experience? You know, those are the sorts of immediate downsides I would see. But on upsides, I think it would be good for other players in the industry, good for the industry in general, good for consumers, and good for the potential of, you know, advertising.
Yeah, definitely good to have that competition to keep the industry healthy. John, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I mean, as long as they keep letting ITV make Love Island, at least half the Exchange Wire office is going to be appeased. So, yeah, no, I can only echo Rachel on that. It's, you know, they it's interesting how it is, how it consolidates and where it shifts to another powerhouse of production, but also it will provide higher quality shows. It will give Banijay new reach. It's interesting. So, yeah, only hopefully a net positive for the consumer and the ad experience. Yeah.
Also, I didn't realise the types of productions that Banijay Group were behind. Peaky Blinders, Big Brother, does anyone still watch that? But still shows that I didn't think, you know, I didn't realise they were the production company for that. So.
Yeah, Black Mirror is one that, right. You know, what it's still going. The new series came out this year to some acclaim, yeah. And I did not know they were part of that. So yeah. Very, yeah, it's, yeah, see what they do next with it.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
So now on to our second story, which is from Digiday, looking at publisher revenue. So publishers have witnessed a recent year-over-year spike in referral traffic from Facebook, and it's coinciding with an influx of revenue from Meta's content monetization program. Out of the 10 publishers Digiday spoke to, several are on track to make between 6 and 7 figures this year from Meta's latest content monetization program, which was introduced last October. Publishers have learned not to rely on Meta for consistent revenue or traffic referral. Facebook stopped paying publishers in 2022 for their content to appear in its curated Facebook news tab, and in 2023 removed instant articles, which helped publishers monetize their content in Facebook's mobile app. So Rachel, I'll come to you first. What do you make of this spike in referral traffic?
I mean, it's a good thing for publishers, obviously. Anything that gives publishers more traffic that enables them to monetize that traffic is a good thing. I mean, the spike in referral traffic's pretty interesting. I don't know if this is, you know, a Facebook play to, you know, manipulate things behind the scenes to make them more useful to publishers in the face of all sorts of anti-competition law. Well, not all sorts of, but one big major anti-competition lawsuit coming their way. Of course, that particular lawsuit's got nothing to do with the way that they treat publishers. But is this Facebook sort of trying to appease the market and make themselves relevant in other ways and prove that they are doing things to improve the ability for publishers to monetize their content? Maybe that's what it's about. I just don't know whether, you know, I would approach it somewhat from a perspective of general skepticism. Is it, you know, is this actually going to be sustainable? And I hope that publishers approach it from that point of view too. And in the meantime, though, I think it's an opportunity for publishers, and so make hay while the sun shines, do everything they can to make some revenue off this and see what happens next is what I'd say.
Yeah. John, what do you think?
It's a trap. It's a trap, publishers. No, for some context here, I've just finished reading Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams, who worked at Facebook for a long time.
Yeah, I want to read that. Were we talking about it in the office the other day?
Yeah,
so,
I got a copy. I mean, the marketers are saying it's the book Facebook's trying to ban, and I can see why. It's got some, like, not, I wouldn't say shocking, but it's got some fairly revelatory stuff about their attitude towards not only their staff but the general public. And there's a particularly enlightening part about their view towards publishers and how they saw publishers as something that were the history of the industry, and that Facebook was the future. I mean, there's not, like, it's not uninteresting, this story. It's like Facebook having a renaissance in terms of what they're offering publishers is an interesting headline. Behind it, some are saying that they're making 6 or 7 figures. Some have said that they've made $500 from the content monetization program. And I feel like publishers should be learning from instant articles being put out there for them and then taken away from, you know, the curated Facebook news tab that was meant to promote publishers and give them revenue and then just being shut down when Facebook felt like it. Be wary, be cautious.
Absolutely.
In terms of what Facebook can do. I was saying this last week, it's hard to see companies dancing to Google's tune, but for Facebook in particular, they are not and never have been the publisher's friend. They helped surface content to start with, and then they built a business around monetizing other people's content. And I, as a publisher, I think Rachel's offered the most sage advice there, like, enjoy it if there is any money in it, but don't rely on it and as a revenue stream in the long term, because it will be switched off whenever they feel like switching off.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And I want to read that book as well that you mentioned.
I'd
actually
thoroughly recommend it. I'll bring it into the office before it's banned.
I read Chaos Monkeys when it first came out, which was the book that was written by one of the sort of guys that worked in the early sort of ad division of Facebook. And that was all about not just how that got set up. This was during a time when Facebook had insisted they would never be hosting advertising on their website. And of course, they went on to build a massive advertising business. And a lot of it was about the sentiment between the management team and Facebook ads and how much animosity there was and how it was sort of sidelined as this kind of dirty little secret. And I think bearing that book in mind, I can't wait to read this next book, because I think it just says a lot about the trajectory of that company. And then sort of drawing it back to this story, you're absolutely right, John. Proceed with caution, buyer beware. And hopefully publishers have learnt so much in the intervening 10 to 15 years between those two books that they will use it for what it can potentially provide them with. You know, that you are talking about slightly different formats for ads, so maybe that's going to encourage publishers to experiment with their own ad formats in general and the way that they make those available on other platforms. And I hope that it's also going to encourage them to be a bit more, have a bit more of a test and learn approach to this and use the outputs from this for, you know, proving their analytics, understanding what works for their audience and what doesn't work for their audience. But ultimately, they cannot be in a position where they're relying on social media platforms for monetization. So whatever it does, I hope it doesn't intercept publishers, diversified monetization policies. They've got to carry on with those.
Absolutely. And taken in the context of Facebook removing their moderators and their content moderation, you know, they might be offering more remuneration for what's for publishers in this particular moment. But what's your content appearing next to? It goes back to brand safety, suitability. They've taken away moderation. Like, the platform, I think it's gone from perhaps the first Trump election where it was seen as the Facebook election. He used it in a way no one had done before. And Facebook sort of learned from that and saw the power of their platform. And to the second Trump election, where I think like Zuckerberg was very, very well aware of what his platform could do in amplifying messages and what worked well and what content they particularly used their algorithm to surface. And so, yeah, without the content moderation that they've taken as a form of kissing the ring for the new president, beware, be cautious, get what you can, like, in terms of testing and learning. But I don't see Facebook as a particularly safe social media environment anymore.
Completely agree with that.
Yeah, I agree as well. Yeah, definitely.
I've been radicalized by the book.
I love it.
Yeah, I definitely want to read that. No, yeah, it's true though. It's yeah, publishers shouldn't really be trusting those platforms, especially Meta and Facebook, really.
And even if for no other reason than it goes back to that same sage business advice, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. You cannot rely on a third party to take care of your monetization strategy. So, you know, I think all sound publishers know that.
Yeah, definitely. Now moving on to our last story for today, which is about TikTok. The video giant plans to enter Japan's e-commerce market and is preparing to onboard sellers for its TikTok Shop platform. TikTok's entry into Japan's market comes at a critical time, with the platform facing significant obstacles to continue operations within the US at the moment. The video giant has recently been expanding TikTok Shop in Europe as well. John, is it surprising that TikTok only now plans to enter the Japanese market? which the article mentions it's the world's third largest e-commerce market.
Yeah, I was surprised there was a headline that they were moving into Japan. We know from our own experience from ATS Singapore how well advanced like social commerce is in the region across APAC. And so, it's a surprise that they haven't launched in Japan already. But saying that, you know, it is the third largest e-commerce market in the world, and it's they've probably tested for long enough to know that it will work now in Japan. It'll take off. I know there's a lot hanging over in terms of the ownership of TikTok in the States and how that divestment is going. But I think moving into Japan seems like a fairly safe bet for TikTok if they want to put, you know, if they're going to bet the farm on the social commerce offering, then they're moving into the right place. And as I say, it's already, we've seen how well it works across Southeast Asia and how well adopted it's been. So yeah, interesting.
Yeah, no, I was surprised as well to see that it hadn't expanded there already.
Yeah, it seems like such a natural fit, given what we know about kind of how advanced the mobile market in particular is there. It's
definitely. Rachel, what are your thoughts?
I think that the reasons might be that the demographics of the Japanese market are quite significantly different to Southeast Asia, much older demographic. And I think even though it's a big e-commerce market, it's quite a sophisticated e-commerce market. And what that e-commerce market is typically comprised of is quality, well, it's focused, and this is part of Japanese sort of consumer society anyway, focused on customer service and, you know, good quality e-commerce experience. Whereas I think TikTok's platform strengths have been largely focused on entertainment, bringing entertainment into that kind of shopping environment. So entertainment and shoppability for product discovery that isn't in a direct selling way. So I think that's why it's taken them a little while to get into the market. I think it's a product that they've seen do really well elsewhere in Asia and also elsewhere in the world, and probably mostly amongst a significantly younger demographic than in Japan, at least. I know the demographics for TikTok consumers are changing all the time. And of course, 2-3 years ago, it was really young people mostly in most markets consuming on TikTok. These days, definitely not. It's much more diverse. But I'd say that in Japan, it would be even, I'd say that diversification is slower. And we do see that sometimes. You're right, both of you, that, you know, it seems surprising on the face of it, because we know that Asia in general, the entire continent, is very mobile first, very e-commerce focused, very digitized. But Japan is slightly more conservative than the rest of Asia, and particularly when it comes to quality shopping experience. They're really focused on customer service, and there'll be an expectation when people purchase in an e-commerce environment that there is a clear route to who you're purchasing from, how to contact someone if you're not happy with the transaction. Not saying that that's not available on TikTok, but I bet a couple of years ago that road was a bit rockier. So I imagine, you know, this is my own opinion, so it could be a load of nonsense, but I imagine that they have spent some time working on their product and what that will look like when they launch into the Japanese market. And in my view, they should, because this is a different Asian demographic. It will be really well received if they've paid attention to those things. The sophistication of purchasing online will be no problem for the Japanese consumer, but it is an older demographic and they will have some customer service expectations. And again, you know, it's not just all about direct purchasing. There'll clearly be an advertising element, but we know that one of the reasons TikTok really wants to break into that market is because they want to diversify their monetization strategy too, and not just rely solely on advertising revenue. And that means they are bringing that shoppable experience into the Japanese market. So it's got to be slick for it to work there.
Yeah, that's true. On that note, do you think TikTok Shop will be able to compete successfully with the other giants in the landscape?
So I think that those other giants in the landscape, if we think about Yahoo, I don't know how big Amazon are in Japan. I feel like they are quite significantly large. They've definitely got a jump start, but they will be banking on a traditional e-commerce play. I do think this is where TikTok will have an edge because they'll be introducing that shoppability element. And I don't see any reason why that shouldn't, like I said, executed well, really explode in the Japanese consumer market. I think that sort of shoppable commerce format is something that the Japanese market won't be suspicious of in the same way that we might be in Western economies. So I think they've got a real opportunity there, but they have to get the experience right. So yeah, they're certainly behind the incumbents. Because the incumbents have been in the market for a long time. And as I said, the Japanese market can be a bit conservative. But if they get the product right and they really have managed that challenge of bringing entertainment and shoppability to e-commerce, underlined with some kind of reliable, you know, customer service thread, they stand to do very well. And yeah. But they've also got to be in it for the long term. That's another interesting thing because we know there's a lot of volatility around TikTok and security concerns. The other thing about the average Japanese consumer is that they expect stable businesses to stick around for a while. So they're going to be much more trusting if they feel like they're entering TikTok or entering the market for the long term.
Yeah, but it sounds like there's huge potential for them if they play their cards right. John, what are your thoughts?
I'm nothing further from me really on this. I think it's I'm really glad to have some background from Rachel on the Japanese market. You know, you're a veteran which of ATS Tokyo,
which so. I could have got completely wrong, but
I think it's really it makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, they have got regulatory issues. I think that has to be said as well. You know, there's 12 countries where it's been banned or regulated, and I wonder. You'd have thought quite a lot of thought's gone into entering the Japanese market, which I wouldn't imagine wouldn't be slow to also regulate it if they don't like what they're doing and what the possibilities are.
100%. Yeah. You know, that if they haven't wrapped their heads around how to tackle security concerns and regulatory issues in other markets, Japan is not the place to experiment with that. There is already political tension between those two countries that periodically flares up. The Japanese won't hesitate to remove, a business from the consumer market if they've got suspicions about it. So you're right, that's another variable. Have they got their act together in that department?
Yeah, and we saw what happened in Indonesia. I think, you know, Kieron calls it parish pump politics, where the small stores that made, you know, a roaring trade on things that were then sold on TikTok shop found their businesses were restricted by it. And then obviously the government comes in as unrest grows. But yeah, that's they must have learned from that experience on what not to do in terms to ruffle feathers and get restricted in a market. So yeah, interested in how Japan adapts to TikTok. But it does feel like, you know, you've said mature market, but probably ready for that kind of innovation now if it's set up properly.
Yeah. And I've got no idea how much that sort of small corner store, mom and pop shop phenomenon translates to Japan. It's certainly a much more sophisticated country from an infrastructure point of view. So I think that is mirrored in their retail environment. But you still don't know. There is, anytime I've spent time in Japan, and it's mostly Tokyo, but a little bit outside of Tokyo, there is a plethora of, in the way that there is in other Asian countries, little corner stores and little specialist stores. So I don't know how important that is culturally to be retained in the retail shopping mix in Japan. So that could be another angle as well. But that can be both a plus and a minus, right? So maybe TikTok is a platform, provides a platform opportunity to those smaller stores, but also maybe, you know, the retail market wants to protect, certain cultural approaches to shopping. We'll see. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. It's been a bit chaotic for TikTok lately, so yeah, we'll see how they deal with that. Yeah. Well, that's a good note to wrap up on. Thanks both for joining me. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.